is a proud co-sponsor of The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a film premiere gala and fundraiser for Outside the Frame, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Outside the Frame is a new organization that empowers homeless and marginalized youth by producing films with youth that convey their life experience. They will premiere The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a riff on Peter Pan, where real lost boys and girls debate if and how to return to mainstream society. They will also screen original film shorts by homeless youth about issues such as drug abuse, gender identity, and the healthcare system. Again, that's The Lost Boys of Portlandia, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Pinkwashing Exposed, will play Thursday, June 9th at 7 p.m. Pinkwashing is a term used when entities engaged in terrible human rights violations promote themselves as gay-friendly to improve their public image. Israel is the country most famous for this strategy. Pinkwashing Exposed explores how pinkwashing works and what activists are doing to fight back, including activists from Seattle who succeeded in 2012 in canceling high-profile queer events, and more. Again, that's Pinkwashing Exposed. Thursday, January 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Law and Disorder.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Michael Ratner died after an 8-month battle with cancer on May 11th of 2016. Today, we dedicate our show and reflect back on Michael Ratner's contribution to the movement and his role in the show Law and Disorder. Heidi, how did you first meet Michael?
Michael, when I started working at the National Lawyers Guild in 1999, I of course knew of Michael's reputation and the many cases he's brought and the various issues that he championed over the years. I first actually saw him at a Columbia Law School event in 1999. I think it was involving Cuba and the embargo. And then in my office, I saw his name everywhere because he was a longtime supporter of the Guild in many respects and was universally loved, respected, admired, and seen as a mentor to many new generations of young radical attorneys and legal workers. Then you called me in 2004 and invited me to be a part of this show. And so I really started to get to know Michael, the person, that year, and remember soon after attending an award ceremony at Columbia Law School where he got their Public Interest Law Foundation Award in 2005, and also the Columbia Law School Medal of Honor. And from there, as Law and Disorder took off, it's just been a mixture of really rare, serious, thoughtful interviews, interactions with a lot of good humor thrown in. The humanity also that Michael brought. Unexpected surprises. I remember once after speaking about my Armenian grandfather and mother escaping the genocide. A few weeks later, a big box arrived from Amazon with no name on it. And I opened it up and it was a really heavy, complete anthology on the Armenian genocide, and I quickly realized Michael had sent it without a note, just a very thoughtful, generous person. Michael, I know that you go back far longer than I do with Michael, so I'd like to hear how you first met him, but I also know that he had an interesting take on the rule of law.
A take that we all share, but I first met him when I lived around the corner from him in Greenwich Village back in the early 80s. And Michael had just gotten elected as the president of the National Lawyers Guild. And he walked around the corner, and schlepped up four flights of stairs to our walk-up where I was living with my wife, Debbie, and our very young son, Eli. And he asked me if I would be on the editorial board of Guild Notes, which was the Lawyers Guild magazine. I said, sure, I'd like to do that. And that's when I started working with Michael. Michael's conception of the law, American law, well, he initially started out, I guess like we all did, Heidi, thinking that the law was a civilized way of resolving disputes. And whatever defects it might have, those could be fixed. Well, he quickly realized that that was not the case. And he came to understand that the law was a method of social control exercised by the 1% over the rest of us and exercised by any means necessary for as long as possible so they could keep their privileges and power. And that was the perspective that Michael had throughout his entire adult life as a litigator. He wanted to expose the law, undercut the law, change it if he could, change it in tandem with the movement because he thought that lawyers in the final analysis played an auxiliary role and that it was the people's movement that caused social change. But he thought that the movement could make use of the law and he wanted to be an instrument in that endeavor.
Michael, we had a lot of fun over the last 14 years and I will cherish these memories. We've been likened here on Law and Disorder by a few as the car talk of Legal Affairs Show. And I also remember when I got an award from the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild in 2011, you and Michael introduced my getting that award and were as humorous and insightful and really magnanimous as you always have been on the radio show, and I thought that sort of summarized the kind of working relationship we had.
We weren't that magnanimous. You did a good job. You ran the Guild for 15 years, and the Guild caused a lot of trouble under your tenure, Heidi.
I hope you mean good rabble-rousing.
But, you know, I think we should say something about some of the cases that
yes,
Michael handled and talk about how he came to do what he did. He came from an upper-middle-class Jewish family in Cleveland, went to Brandeis, which was a fairly radical place in the 60s. You know, Herbert Marcuse, the famous philosopher, was there. He was a classmate of Angela Davis's. When he got out, he was accepted to Columbia Law School. He wasn't all that political then. He devoted his first year exclusively to studying, did pretty well, came out first in his class, went on to the Law Review.
Not surprising.
But what changed him was what happened when the police attacked the students at Columbia back in 68. Columbia had been expanding its campus into the Harlem area. It wanted to build a gymnasium with two entrances, one for the privileged Columbia students and one for the Harlem population. And it was also extensively tied up with America's prosecution of the war in Vietnam. So the students held a sit-in, and the Columbia authorities called the cops on the sit-in. Michael was caught up in that, beaten up. 700 people were arrested. 200 people were sent to the hospital. The National Lawyers Guild came and defended those students.
That became really the beginning of their well-known mass defense program, and they've been defending people in the streets of protest ever since.
It certainly did. I mean, the Lawyers Guild was really a victim of the McCarthy era, which we were just coming out of even in the 60s. And that defense revivified the Lawyers Guild in New York City and then later on nationally. And Michael was on the ground floor of that. So then he went on when he graduated from law school. He worked for the Legal Defense Fund, which was the legal arm of the Black
NAACP,
at the time. Moved down to Baltimore, lived in a motel, did work on school desegregation, came back to New York, got a job with Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first black judge in the federal judiciary.
And he always spoke so highly of her.
And vice versa. She thought he was the best clerk she ever had. And then in 71, when he finished his clerkship, he started working for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was a scrappy, small little organization then. The first week, they sent him up to Buffalo to the Attica prison. Rockefeller was the governor then. Rockefeller wanted to be the president. He didn't want to be looked upon as being soft on prisoners. And when the Attica prisoners took over the prison, the governor called in the state troopers. 43 people were murdered by the state troopers. The Center for Constitutional Rights got in on it and sent Michael up to take statements to try to figure out what to do. And so Michael's first lawsuit was actually called Attica People Against Rockefeller. They tried to get the state to appoint a prosecutor to prosecute the murderers. They didn't succeed on that. But that started Michael off in his political representation from 1971 until 2015.
And Michael, I think for listeners who may not totally understand the nuances of some lawyering, Michael was really a radical attorney, and that's kind of a dying breed. Lawyers who will really take chances. They will take cases because they believe so firmly in the underlying principle and the violations that have occurred that even if the possibility of success in court is very low, they will still take the case to get that message out into the public's eye. Yeah, and that Michael believed in that.
Absolutely. And you know, to work with the movement in doing that.
Yeah.
He didn't believe American law in the final analysis was compatible with democracy, nor did he believe that it was compatible with the rule of law. We saw that most clearly with what happened after 9/11 and the setting up of the offshore prison in Cuba, the creation of a surveillance state, the massive harassment, the militarization of the police, the FBI's spying. But Michael understood that fundamentally. He knew that the rule of law and democracy was not compatible with capitalist law. And he knew that capitalism wasn't compatible with an egalitarian society. And it was that understanding, I think, that empowered him in the litigation that he undertook.
Michael was also an activist, as I think we all are on the show. He opposed Abu Ghraib torture and prisoner abuse, as well as the Iraq War. He served as an expert witness at a mock tribunal staged by the Bush Crimes Commission at the Columbia University. More recently, in May 2014, he resigned from the advisory board of the International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life at Brandeis, where, as you said, he went to school, because the university's president cut ties with Al-Quds, a Palestinian university, after a student demonstration there. So that's who Michael was. If he saw an injustice, he would do something about it.
No, he was in total solidarity with the Palestinian people. In fact, he organized and got the financial support to set up Palestine Legal, which is fighting back against the repression of Palestinian
with the New York,
students.
With the National Lawyers Guild.
Absolutely.
Right. That was very important and still is.
I think that if you want to look back at some of his most significant cases, Heidi, he sued Ronald Reagan for the funding of Contras in Nicaragua,
right,
and for invading Grenada. He sued George Bush 41, the first one, for invading Iraq without congressional authority.
Mm-hmm.
He sued Bill Clinton for warehousing Haitians with HIV in the offshore prison camp, which we now know as Guantanamo.
He served as special counsel to Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, assisting in prosecuting human rights crimes.
He sued the Secretary of Defense under Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, for torture. He sued Indonesian generals, a Guatemalan defense minister who he served when the guy was being given a degree at Harvard. He sued a Haitian dictator, all for human rights abuses.
And he tried to get Clinton to stop the strategic bombing during the Kosovo War.
He sued the FBI for spying on Central American Solidarity activists and CSPES during the 80s. He sued the Pentagon for restricting press coverage of the Gulf War.
He won a case on behalf of victims of the Bosnian Serb leader for war crimes.
And he organized what they called the Guantanamo Bar Association, which was the greatest mass mobilization of lawyers the country's ever seen. He got 500 lawyers to come in after they won the case of Rasul versus Bush, which established that the prisoners in the offshore prison camp in Guantanamo had the right to habeas corpus. They had the right to challenge their detention. They had the right to go in front of a court and tell the judge, I don't think I'm being held legally. Let's look into this. A habeas corpus, the fundamentals, it's written into the U.S. Constitution. And he restored the habeas corpus and then organized 500 lawyers to continue with those cases. They didn't totally win, but they got 500 out of some 700 prisoners out of there.
A Herculean task.
You know, and we should also mention that he was the president of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights,
right,
which is kind of the European version of the
CCR.
CCR, yeah.
And I think when it all comes down to his legacy, he will be remembered as a compassionate, loving, really humanitarian attorney who was really loved by all who knew him.
And that sea of people, which includes you and me, Heidi, and our producer, Jeff Brady, who he influenced and continues to motivate. I wanted to say something about Michael in perspective, because Michael Ratner had no funeral. He wasn't religious. Religion to him was superstition. Being part of a sect was too narrow and confining. The Jewish heretic who transcends Jewry belongs to a Jewish tradition. The historian Isaac Deutscher had a phrase for it, the non-Jewish Jew. Michael Ratner was in line with the great heretics, rebels, and revolutionaries of modern thought, Spinoza, Heine, Marx, Luxembourg, Trotsky, Freud. They all went beyond the boundaries of Jewry, finding it too narrow, archaic, constricting. I don't wish to stretch the comparison. Michael was not so much a radical thinker as a man of action, but his intellectual understanding, and he was extremely well-educated, powered his activity. He had in common with these great thinkers the idea that for knowledge to be real, it must be acted upon. As Marx observed, hitherto philosophers